The following is a book on MP3. Part 1. Boiling Point. The Breakup of the United States of America and Its Citizens by Tom Merritt. To my friends of the past who gave me inspiration for this. To Eileen, who is my future. Boiling Point in print is copyright 1997. Revised edition copyright 2006. Tom Merritt, all rights reserved. The digital edition and this podcast version are Creative Commons Share Alike 2.5. The story was begun in 1993 after reading The Nine Nations of North America by Joel Garreau. It was completed in 1997 and revised and e-published in 2000. The e-published version went out of business shortly after that. It has been lightly revised again in 2006. The reference to a fire in New Orleans in 2005 was written sometime in 1996, so was not corrected to hurricane, which would have fit reality. Still, it's pretty spooky. References to desk sets and the net have not been changed since they were originated in 1994. This can be evidenced by the form of email addresses, which include a server name and the domain extension. Maybe that's dated, or maybe that's just indicating we'll have to get back to requiring server identification in the future. Only Steve's dad knows for sure. The President, Chapter 1, Washington, D.C. The sunshine glowed hot and red through the office window. As it set, the President felt as if it might never rise again. He looked at the executive order on his desk. He knew the consequences. The trouble in the Dakotas would escalate. Texas would try to bolt. The entire country would strain. It was all he could do. Some decades ago, there had been a surplus. It dried up as people lived longer and retired in droves, not to mention the expense of pet projects of past presidents. Now the country faced problems 10 times worse than the money woes of the late 20th century. He gazed out the window at the orderly green lawn lit brightly in the midday. Not a soul stirred in that yard. 40 million people waited to hear what he would say tonight. None of them expected what would happen. None of them were prepared. He knew his country. All of history could come crashing down on their heads in the next few days, and they would complain about the traffic. Not until the stores emptied, or the TV went dark, would they really take notice. Then, too late, they would throw open the windows and find the world changed around them. "Sleep well tonight," he said to no one but the sun. "Nothing will ever be the same again." Steve, Chapter 1, Austin, Texas. "For everything?" bellowed the woman standing over the pile of books she'd brought in to sell. "Well, yes, we make an offer on everything you bring in. This stack here is what we can sell. If there's anything in this pile you want to hold on to, it really wouldn't change the offer." "You're trying to cheat me." The well-dressed but heavily made-up woman shook her head and jangled her gold-plated earrings. "No, ma'am, I'm assure you. I'm not trying to cheat. This place is a rip-off. Do you know how much these books cost me?" "If you'd like to hold on to them, that's fine, but I'm afraid..." "Just give me the $4, she snapped. It was another in a series of forgettable moments in an arduous day. After the woman was at a safe distance, I made some cheap, spurious remarks about her taste in clothing, and then looked at the clock. It was 6. "I'm off, Larry. I'll see you. Bye, Steve." He was intent on another pile of books just brought in by an overweight man in a wheelchair. Sweat exploded from my pores less than 20 seconds after I walked out the door. The heat of Austin, Texas settled on me like a drunk on a bar stool. I got in my car and gingerly put my keys in the ignition, careful not to touch the searing hot steering column. I started the car, turned on the radio, and blasted the AC. I hadn't listened to much radio since the latest budget crisis started. Helen was boycotting the news, so I did too. But curiosity finally got the better of me. A talk show host's animated voice barked out a monologue about the budget bill and the fate of the country once again hanging in the balance. The yammering ground to a halt, and the American Belief Radio theme music carried in Greg Whitney, the deep-voiced, slow-speaking, ABR voice of reason. His tone and pitch always promised the truth. I wondered how his kids took it when he told them there was no Santa Claus. As Congress nears the deadline for the emergency economic plan, the President called for compromise. Republicans still called the social programs Johnson-like and claims they will weaken the nation. Congressional Democrats accused the Republicans of trying to destroy developing communities within the nation while sending the country into further depression. Speaker of the House Carmen Hinojosa made a fiery speech today from the floor calling for a last-ditch compromise. "We cannot continue to exhume the past while ignoring the needs of our many communities. This is not a Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian issue. We must come together for the good of the people of America." Meanwhile, the South Dakota National Guard still fights to keep order in Pierre, where Native American radicals demand reforms. Experts fear the situation may escalate into a battle for control of the city. And finally, the Texas legislature approved a plan to bring the Texas National Guard under state control. Texas Governor Richard Morgan strongly denied this was a secessionary move. "We feel to more flexibly respond to the rising tide of crime among the poor. An independent unit, which does not need to mess with the federal bureaucracy every time it is needed, will be much more effective." Critics call the separation unconstitutional and fear Texas will not use it for policing crime. I'm Greg Whitney for American Belief Radio. Thank you, Greg. You're listening to ABR's America Considered. Let's hear now from ABR Washington commentator Damian Mortley with Eye on Washington. Kolbrowski, Chapter 1, Highland, Illinois. No one ever mentioned the middle of the country, the heartland. No one noticed and no one listened to us. For 2 years, we knew of the Texas plans. Even now, the country pretended not to see the signs. I looked down into my coffee. "You want anything else, sir?" I looked up into the beaming face of the waitress. Her bright expression dimmed considerably as I stared at her. The pain and despair of a hidden life and a terrible secret apparently showed more than I thought. "No, thanks." "All right, then. I'll just bring you the check." I opened the manila folder and reread the latest reconnaissance and planning documents. We needed a driver, and I knew where to get one, but I didn't like my own idea one little bit. I paid and went back to the car. I could always get someone else, but somehow I knew where it all led. A small part of me always felt a sense of destiny. My priest always tried to convince me it was the call. Maybe it was, but not in the way he meant. A fire burned in the distance. Smoke rose towards the heavens. It seemed to heat the whole sky. I started my car and watched the flames. That was my future. Steve, Chapter 2, Austin, Texas. I sat in the parking lot with the windows down to cool the car while the AC began to work. Customers hurried through the lot to escape the heat into the cool bookstore. I lit a cigarette. One of my least favorite net radio columnists began to exhort another of the multitude of perspectives on the crisis. "People tighten their belts as the economic decline continues, while Congress works to beat the deadline to fund national services like hospitals, toll roads, schools, and police. The strangest thing to me is the talk shows and the news analysts don't sound too worried. Oh, people hotly debate the merits of Gloria Presley's love escapades, but they just laugh off Congress. What do you expect, people say? Congress can't do anything right. They treat the government like a bad sitcom. Tonight, Congress announces its economic plan. The talk shows are all analyzing how much the Republicans will be hurt by the inevitable compromise. All the pundits busily review who's in the front row for the president's announcement. The fact that America goes bankrupt if there is no agreement has only briefly been touched on as something theoretically possible but inconceivable. Of course they'll compromise, say the pundits, and problems will be put off for another year as always. I wonder if people care that little. Is the nation even worth saving? I only pray that my skepticism proves unfounded. I'm Damian Mortley with Eye on Washington. As Mortley finished, I looked up to find a beefy man in a gaudy orange shirt staring at me through the window. "Damian Mortley, huh?" "Yeah. Bunch of fucking liberal bullshit if you ask me. We need to throw everybody out if you ask me." I didn't. I realized I was way too tired to get into an argument. My mouth didn't seem to care. "You vote last election?" "Oh, well, I usually vote, but I was on vacation." "Uh-huh. Could have voted early." "Yeah, but you know, spur-of-the-moment shit like that throws out the best plans." The man began to walk away. "You have plenty of time to whine, though, don't you?" I shouted after him. The man flashed me a dirty look as I put the car in gear and moved out onto Guadalupe Street rush hour traffic. I turned off the radio. After a day of inane questions and boredom, the heat turned my brain to sludge. I wanted to stop and eat at the Real Inn, but I knew Helen was probably cooking. She'd get disappointed if I didn't come straight home. 27 years old and still on a leash. The news wore on me. There was no pattern. I stretched my thin frame and yawned. What would happen if the shit really hit the fan? I looked down at my blue-colored work shirt, black jeans, and wingtips, well-dressed for Armageddon, I thought. The light changed, and I let the GPS drive from there to 45th Access Point. We were all living a lie, I decided, none too profoundly, but it cheered me up somewhat because I couldn't handle that we were living the truth. I wanted to rant. That's what everyone did. No action, just ranting. Los Angeles Peace Party ranted about separatism. The Aryan Nation ranted about supremacy. The African American Front ranted about racism. The Lakota Nation ranted about equality, and the Texans ranted about independence from federal incompetence. Ranting made good TV and relieved everyone, like cooling vents on a hot coil. The heat rises, but the vents keep everything stable, to a point. How far would it go before anger blew the vents and burst the coil? The car rolled off the 45th Street access point, and I took over, pulling into my parking lot. I thought of the 100 or so people in my apartment complex, all angry, I hoped, sitting at home ranting. The stairs were extremely steep as I climbed up to my apartment. The smell of Helen's famous pasta sauce drifted out to meet me and help me up the last flight. "Hey, Steve," she squeaked as I walked in the door. "You look beat." I trudged in, putting on my best 1950s accountant act. "Tough day at the office?" she asked, humoring me. I threw my lanky body down on the couch. "It's dog-eat-dog out there, honey. Man's gotta strive, gotta push, or they'll eat you alive." I jumped back up to follow her. "What you cooking? Can I help?" I was looking over her shoulder at the bubbling red things and the steaming onions. "No, but you could set up the machine to record Daystrom, because I know you'll want to watch that stupid press conference." "Okay." I backed away from the sautéing onions before I started to cry. "I'll probably just listen to it in the bedroom on radio. I dig hearing the news on radio. Makes it seem more like news that way, like people listening to war reports back in the 1940s. I can't believe you keep that old thing around when we have a perfectly good desk set." "Helen, my radio's different. It's nostalgic, like time travel." "How can you have nostalgia for a time you never lived in?" "I don't know. It just seems like people were more of a unit then. Everyone, even the low class and poor, kind of went in the same general direction. Now everyone's all over the place. Things move too fast, too decentralized. Everything's falling apart." "Oh, hush." She stirred the sauce with a wooden spoon. She wore simple black jeans and a plain purple shirt. Her auburn hair just touched her shoulders in a straight bob. Thick-framed glasses covered her mild blue eyes. A simple ensemble, straightforward, practical, and tasteful. Just like her. In this light, she was attractive, pretty, but not beautiful. Picking up two plates heaped with steaming pasta, she waltzed over to the couch and sat down next to me. As usual, she brought water for her, but I had to get up and get my own. We ate and talked, avoiding the news. It made Helen unhappy to think about it, and so she just refused. I never have understood her almost paranoid fear of the world at large. She sometimes screamed and left the room after 2 minutes of news. "I just hate hearing and seeing all that stuff. There's nothing I can do about it, so why should I worry?" she would say when pressed. We ate and played a round of whist. Then Helen sat up on the couch to watch Daystrom. "You go brave the ugliness and then give me the highlights." She shooed me away. I curled up on the bed and turned in one of the few stations left at simulcast on the net and regular air. Most of these stations were National Public Radio, or its federally supported commercial competition, American Belief Radio. I preferred ABR because it seemed more real and more old-time. NPR had a stiff, snooty air about it. Governor Mortigan, Chapter 1, Austin, Texas. Across town in the governor's mansion, Richard Morgan enjoyed the same radio broadcast as Steve for many of the same reasons. Morgan had an old-fashioned streak and enjoyed the drama of radio. It gave the occasion importance. The broadcast began. "It's 9 o'clock at KLBJ Austin," a local voice toned in over the news theme. "This is American Belief Radio News. I'm Greg Whitney. The president will deliver a nationwide media address in just a few minutes. We'll bring that to you live, but first, a summary of today's other top stories. The group Lakota Nation reinforced its midnight deadline for Native American autonomy in the Dakotas by surrounding all state buildings with armed men, including the two state capitol buildings. Police and National Guard troops stood watch to prevent disturbances but remained inactive. The bankrupt South Dakota legislature has not paid the police force in over a month. Guard troops will wait until the president's announcement before attempting to disperse the Lakota Nation militants. Texas Governor Richard Morgan threatened to do, quote, whatever is necessary to protect Texas interests if Congress fails to pass a satisfactory economic package. Texas put its National Guard troops under state control today. Many fear Texas might try to secede before the Supreme Court rules on the removal. Officials on both sides of the issue call these fears alarmist. And now we take you to the White House for the president's address. Morgan fumbled with a pencil as he waited for the address to begin. He knew what was coming. The damn Federalists wouldn't listen to him. They had finally pushed things too far. If the president's address went as expected, there was only one God-given course Morgan could take to protect the families of honest people given into his care. The pencil broke. He leaned in toward his radio, his gnarled features glowing blood red in the light of the dial. Deep crevices of black lined his face where years of maneuvering and deal cutting had left their mark. His cold blue eyes burned with anticipation. His face grew angry at the idea of what the president would say, but deep inside his glacial soul, he wanted this excuse more than anything in the world. It wasn't for freedom. It wasn't for Texas. It was for Richard Morgan. He wanted the chance to realize what he knew he had been born to do. Take the reins, any reins, and lead a people to a higher, better state. A gavel sounded, and a voice broke through. "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America." Staged applause erupted through the speakers. A man with a slightly southern accent began to intone in the methodical pattern that had swept him into office. "Good evening, fellow Americans. I called this address tonight with the hopes of bringing you the good news of an economic compromise that could work for all. Unfortunately, the political gridlock of partisanship has prevented that compromise from being reached, and tomorrow the nation goes bankrupt. I have, regretfully and with trepidation, prepared an executive plan that I hoped I would not have to use, but I will, because this nation is too great and too proud to sink into the embarrassment of bankruptcy." Morgan's eyes glowed and spun with raging delight. Back across town and slightly uphill, Steve's heart sank at what he guessed would follow. "Therefore, effective at noon tomorrow, I will sign executive orders declaring martial law in many parts of the nation where police forces go unfunded. All remaining money will be transferred on emergency status to the military, which will fill the positions left empty by Congress. Those left unemployed by the federal government will have assistance, and several corporations have agreed to provide easy hiring to former federal employees. Eventually, we hope to hire you back. The executive orders will limit the military to performing civilian roles under civilian law. Each order will be effective for only 1 month at a time to allow us to reevaluate what is needed each month. This will not be a dictatorship. These orders will remain well within constitutional limits. If Congress can pass a plan which will put the federal government back on its feet, then these orders will be countermanded immediately. I thank you for your patience and assistance, and I know together, as Americans, the nation can pull through the tough times ahead. Let us not forget the words of our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln. United we stand, divided we fall. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America." This is American Belief Radio. The new Saturn Kennedys are here, and the financing is better than ever. Steve, Chapter 3, Austin, Texas. I turned down the sound and waited for the analysis from ABR's team of marginally intelligent political pundits. This is American Belief Radio. I'm Greg Whitney. With me are Elizabeth Rochester, professor of political science at the University of Michigan, Ellen Mubarak, chief analyst of America's first political division, and Jose Luis Pena, former Secretary of Commerce under President Jane Michel. The analysts cut the speech into its constituent signs, symbols, and signifiers. They fawned over the signals sent out to Texas and South Dakota and the powerful use of Abraham Lincoln, even though Lincoln didn't actually say the United States we stand, quote. I noticed they ignored the fascist aspects of the orders and the fact that a president who was denying that the country was in danger of civil war was using the ghost of Lincoln to bolster his position. I knew why, too. If the president let the country slip into bankruptcy, the government would have to submit to UN stewardship of the economy until the nation was solvent. That was certainly better than martial law, where constitutional freedoms become questionable. But neither party wished to test the irrational fear of the UN that had bred itself in the more suspicious citizens of the U.S. The analysts finished by agreeing that this was as bad as it could possibly get. I walked quietly into the front room and found Helen on the phone, her face blank. "Yeah, I understand. Okay. Well, it's certainly not your fault, Mindy. Yeah, I know. Well," she sighed. "I guess that's what I'll do then. All right. See you later." "Mindy?" "Yeah, she called me to tell me not to come to work tomorrow because all non-military related jobs have been temporarily laid off. That means a library will operate with a skeleton crew of the most senior and most Texan staff. Man, I was born in Lubbock. I don't see why years of state residency should have anything to do with why you're kept on or not. What about job servicing?" "Well," she said, "there'd be some sort of federal corporate job bank, but the University of Texas isn't involved, so of course they won't tell anybody anything about it." "It's not exactly what I'd call easy hiring." "What?" Helen looked annoyed. "The president promised easy hiring, and that's exactly what you're not getting." I don't know. I guess I'll just go to the unemployment office tomorrow and see what's up there. You and 200,000 of your closest friends. Will you shut up? Helen looked away. It's hard enough without being negative. Sorry, I was just pointing out the facts, that's all. I mean, you have to face them. Well, why do you have to be the one in charge of making me face them? She yelled. You face them. Leave me alone. Why does this all have to happen now? Why to us? Why? She looked at me plaintively now, as if somehow I knew the answer and could make everything better. But I couldn't. I didn't know what to do to stop it, and worse, I didn't care. I felt like slapping her for some reason and telling her to get over it and get on with her life. Complaining and whining won't make it better. Instead, I softly said, "Come here." She stepped toward me, and I held her tight, staring into the corner, waiting for the right amount of time to pass. "It's going to be okay," I spat out quickly while my face grew hot with anger. Why couldn't she be stronger? We agreed to forget it for the moment and headed off to bed. I lay beside her quietly, wishing she wasn't there. I feared she could hear my thoughts or somehow divine them by my movements and my breathing. I feared her. That's why she angered me. I feared getting close, feeling responsible, and having to help her. I didn't want the responsibility of soothing her insecurities when I had so many of my own. I needed her strength to bolster mine, and I felt she sucked mine away. Every minute I devoted to calming her or helping her depleted my reserve of self-sufficiency. I felt that reserve nearing empty. As I drifted off to sleep, I imagined her limping off along a dusty road. I walked beside her, trying to keep her from falling. She instructed me how to turn and what steps to take to keep her up. Yet with every step I faltered and fell myself. The longer we walked, the closer to the ground I came. Before my mind drifted into sleep, I met the ground and felt her standing straight upright on top of me as I buried my face in the dirt. Kolbrowski, Chapter 2, Greenville, Illinois. I sat at the poker table, eyeing my two buddies, John and Gehrig. I knew they were steamed at this last hand, and I was lapping it up. "Sorry, boys, couldn't help it." "Fuck, Kolbrowski, let me see your sleeves." "Shut up, John, I've got short sleeves on." I flapped them open for everyone to see. "That supposed to convince me of anything?" Gehrig went and sat in the corner to smoke. He knew I didn't approve of his habit, so he always got as far away from me as possible. I just wanted to help. "Hell of a thing, that announcement," Gehrig said to nobody. John rose from the couch, annoyed. "Shit, why'd you have to bring that up, Gehrig?" "I don't know that it's such a bad thing, necessarily. Maybe it's what we need to get back on our feet." "Or destroy the country," I shot back. "What's left of it," added John. "Why are you two always so down on the nation? We're still the second largest power in the world. We're third in food production. We have one of the top military forces." I shared a glance with John. "Listen to your numbers, Gehrig. No firsts. And yet, the government just keeps on going as if nothing's wrong. Shit, man, I'm not a big UN fan. But I'd almost rather see us hook into one of those economic stupid ship things than live under federal martial law." "Yeah, well, what are you going to do about it, Kolbrowski? Go to your psych association meetings and whine about cortex research?" needled Gehrig. A sly smile crept across my face like a bug. John laughed. "Yeah, Gehrig, that's exactly what he's going to do." "Shut up, John." We didn't need to lead Gehrig that way. Not yet. "I didn't say nothing," John muttered as he took another Coke out of the refrigerator. Gehrig stood up. "Well, Colby, you want to ride in together tomorrow?" "Yeah, I'll meet you at McDonald's at 8. "Sounds good. See you, John." "Bye, Gehrig." I waited for the door to close and turned on John. "Can't you keep your big mouth shut? He gets more suspicious all the time." "Why don't you just invite him in?" John stared directly at me. "Because I don't want to take that responsibility. You joined all on your own without me. You remember how much we talked about whether we should be in this thing. It should be like that for everybody." John shook his head. "We all heard from someone, Colby. It might as well be from you. Besides, with you and me, it's a bit different." "I guess, but I just can't drag Gary again. I can't. Not unless things really get hairy. I'm going to hit the sack. Good night." "Night." John picked up a copy of Protector magazine. "I'll be in a while." From my bedroom window, I saw Gary leaning against a post on the front porch of the house. I knew he didn't like to smoke in his car. At least that would have been his excuse if I nabbed him eavesdropping. I could tell he didn't know what to do with the information he'd just heard. I also knew he was quick enough to figure it out before long. He walked down the steps and got into his 2-year-old brown Saturn Guthrie and drove off. I leaned back on my bed, turned on the box. They blabbed on about the President's speech, the Texas Army, and the Lakota Nation. It all seemed unreal to me living in Greenville. Nothing ever changed here. A business closed or opened occasionally. Rumors started about some building scheme on the edge of town which would ruin the already dead downtown area. What would happen if Texas seceded? If Lakota Nation rioted in Pierre? Nothing would happen to Greenville. You'd still have to drive 20 miles to get a decent department store. There wasn't much chance of any history happening. That's why people were so paranoid and useless at the same time. They kept hearing about bad things happening around the country, but they never happened to them, so they got paranoid, waiting for the axe to fall. Some got soft over the years, noticing that whatever way they voted for president, nothing seemed to change in their immediate locale. I didn't want that to happen to me. I wanted to be there and know, man. I wanted to know. The Sun, Chapter 1. The night wore out, giving way to sunrise. The summer sun rolled through one more day as Helen hunted jobs and Steve hunted reasons. The sun beat through the office window of Texas Governor Richard Morgan as he eyed the bill that could likely become a piece of history. His allies in Congress had drafted the secession resolution on his request. He felt the fate of Texas, and perhaps the U.S., was in his hands. He could still back out, and he would, if he weren't sure this was the only way to maximize the benefits. He held it up to the light, a piece of history. His to make or not make, gleaming black and white, waiting for his gesture to send it into motion. A man making history with the sun beating on him, warming him, making him feel the rush of the moment flood through him and exhilarate him. In his mind, he imagined himself sharing a timeless experience with Caesar, Napoleon, even Hitler. He pressed the intercom buttons ceremoniously. The sun moved on, scorching New Mexico and Oklahoma, where the military patrolled small-town streets, and the court system welcomed its first MPs as bailiffs. It streaked up the mountains of Colorado, shining on a woman biking up a hill in Denver. That's the end of part 1.